If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Kia ora e te whanau. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Adam On, your host for the New Books in Australian and New Zealand Studies podcast. I hope you're all doing well, especially in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where we are going through some growing pains dealing with the pandemic at the moment. I find the best thing to do for me during lockdown is to read a lot of books and then listening to the authors talk about those books. But I'm in a privileged position to be able to actually talk to the authors. So today we are talking to Mark Beery. His new book, Queer Existence, is a major documentary project that uses photographic portraiture and oral history to record the life experiences of a group of 27 gay men born since the passing of the Homosexual Law Reform Act in 1986, which is a major milestone in New Zealand legislative history. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for your invitation.
Yes, so Mark, to start with, can we please have, for the listeners, some background? What is your background and how did you become a writer, a photographer, and what then led you to this project?
Yes, so I've had two parallel careers for the last 20-odd years or so. My initial training was in medicine, and I graduated in medicine in 1990 and qualified as a specialist physician. So I worked in hospitals around New Zealand for nearly 30 years. Alongside that, I've developed a parallel career as a photographer and writer. So I went to art school initially in 2001, I think it was. I started at the Elam School of Fine Arts in Auckland, and I completed a Bachelor of Fine Arts then. And later on, back in 2012, I went on and did a Master of Fine Arts, and that was the basis or the point of origin of this project. The first few interviews and photographs that I did for this project were the basis of my Master of Fine Arts degree.
Cool. So what motivated you to have a pictorial and oral history together, because we don't usually do that or see that in regular oral history writing?
Well, as I've said, my background was in photography. So I started off by taking photographs, and I did a previous book of mine was called Men Alone, Men Together, which came out in 2010. And that was about gay men and their relationships. So I photographed 15 single guys and 14 couples and one threesome. And that book was published by Steele Roberts Publishers more than 10 years ago now. And that was the that was based on my final year's work for my Bachelor of Fine Arts degree. So I started off by photographing these people. And initially, it was almost alongside the photographs that I interviewed them. One of my sources of inspiration, and perhaps people with a knowledge of New Zealand photography will recognize this, was a book called Working Men by Glenn Bush, which came out in the 1980s and featured wonderful black and white photographs of guys in manual occupations. And alongside that were interviews talking about their experiences in life. And that was one of my earliest sources of inspiration. So that was what I was drawing on. And there is actually, in photography, there is quite a long tradition of collections of photographs with interviews or with first-person narratives from the people photographed. So I was drawing on that tradition. And then when I came to do this current book, A Queer Existence, I was working within that model. And it, although taking the photographs was a key part of the work I was doing, hearing these guys' stories and making their stories available and putting them on record was another key part of that. So in terms of my work, I've always worked with both text and image, and that seems to be the way that my, if you like, my practice has developed.
Yes, it was a great experience to read the book, because the photographs are right at the start, after the history section, after the introductory section, and then all the stories come in. And what I found myself doing was that I went through each and every picture, and then after I read the story, I went back and looked at the picture again. I don't know why, but it was like I had known the person more now, so I can. It's not just a static photograph, and it has a history behind it. So that was quite fantastic. Now, to start with, as far as the history is concerned, and you have kind of milestoned it around the Homosexual Reform Act in 1986. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Why was that point?
Yes. So before homosexual law reform, sexual acts between men in Aotearoa, New Zealand, were illegal. And that had been part of the history since the colonial era. The evidence we have is that in pre-colonial times, Maori attitudes towards same-sex intimacy were accepting and welcoming. And we have the word takatapui, which means an intimate companion of the same sex, which is the Maori word or the indigenous word that was used in pre-colonial times as it is thought and has been revived in the last recent decades. But during the colonial era, sex between men was outlawed and made illegal, and that persisted. And obviously, during the 60s and 70s, there was an increasing awareness of, if you like, the rights and the importance of allowing liberty to particularly gay men, but lesbian women as well. And as I describe in the introduction, the beginnings of a campaign for reform in the law date back to the I'm just checking the dates. I'm sorry to pause a moment to.
No, that's all right.
Yep. 1962, the Dorian Society was formed in Wellington. That was the first. It was called a homophile organisation. And that became the precursor of the first New Zealand Homosexual Law Reform Society, which was really founded in 1963. So that's the beginnings of a campaign for law reform. And it really took off during the 70s with the gay liberation era, and then coming through into the early 1980s, the AIDS epidemic also had a huge impact on gay men and their lives in New Zealand, but was also part of the driver for law reform. One of the paradoxes about the fact that sex between men was technically illegal was that with the onset of the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s and the realization that condom use could help prevent the transmission of HIV, the New Zealand Health Department was unable to mount an effective public health campaign, was unable to promote condom use because they would have been viewed as promoting an illegal activity. Mm-hmm. So that was another part of the driver. But there had been a few attempts at law reform prior to the act that was passed in 1986. And they had failed for various reasons, but the campaign really took off in 1984 and 1985 when a member of parliament, Fran Wild, was approached by the gay community and asked to sponsor a bill to promote law reform. And that was led to the homosexual law reform bill that was introduced to parliament in 1985. And then was passed in 1986. Mm. So that's a sort of encapsulated historical background.
So a couple of things that intrigued me in terms of the roadblocks to opening up or the legislation through the Homosexual Law Reform Act. One of the things you mentioned was the age of consent. Can you elaborate how did that affect the slow progress through the 2 years that this law reform took to pass?
Yes, so there were different schools of thought. There was a more, if you like, a more radical school of thought that advocated very strongly that sex between men or homosexual sex should be treated exactly the same as heterosexual sex. In other words, the age of consent, which was 16 for sex between male and female, should be exactly the same for sex between men. There was another more conservative group that would have been perhaps more comfortable with the British model, where the age of consent had been set at 20 or 21 in the first instance. And there was a more, as I said, conservative group of people who would have been happy with that. And so there were different groups or different opinions. But in the end, the body of opinion that carried the day was the one that said that sex between men should be treated exactly the same as heterosexual sex. And I think that was really important in the end in saying that this is not something that needs special treatment, that this is something that should be regarded as part of the spectrum of human activity and human rights, and that gay people should be regarded in law as no different from anyone else.
Yes, it was quite interesting reading through the history, and essentially, it hasn't been, because I did some background research, and there's deep dives into the time of the law reform, but not as much. It's mainly news-based stories. Now, the time. When we're talking about the 50s and the 60s, you kind of differentiate the New Zealand movement and the US movement. Can you elaborate a little bit on those differences and how we adopted or how it helped New Zealand?
Yes, I guess we're talking perhaps in the first instance about Well, if we want to get into the history, there were, if you like, two waves. There was what they call the homophile movement, which was really dates back in the United States back to the 1950s and in New Zealand to the 60s, which was more about promoting, wanting to promote the impression or the image of gay men, or it would have been homosexual, would have been the term used then, as decent and respectable and well-adjusted members of society. And so the idea or the emphasis was on avoiding scandal and promoting the idea that homosexual men in particular could be upright and respectable citizens. Then in the 1970s, the gay rights movement was came along, and that, of course, dates back to the Stonewall Inn riots in 1969 in New York, which really led to the gay rights movement, which is altogether more radical, challenged norms of capitalist society, challenged heteronormative norms of bourgeois life, and drew on ideas from feminism, Marxism, pacifism, and black rights, and presented homosexuality not as some abnormal behavior, but an innate part of the makeup of an oppressed minority group, and developed the idea of coming out as an essential part of claiming one's true personhood. And so gay rights was much more radical, much more, if you like, left-wing, much more progressive. And in New Zealand, that was launched in 1972 with a demonstration in a park in Auckland, Albert Park, which is right next to the university campus. And so gay rights groups were formed throughout the country and were active throughout the 1970s. And that was the movement, really, that I guess fed into the law reform campaign. But in the law reform campaign, there were many, many different groups of, or there was a wide range of opinion being drawn on. And so I guess you ask about the difference between overseas and New Zealand. I think part of the thing is that in New Zealand, I guess we were perhaps a few years behind other parts of the world. We also, though, had, as I said, this campaign for law reform coincided with the AIDS epidemic, and that I think was a particularly important driver in the New Zealand situation.
Cool, thanks. Thanks for that. Now, getting into the people, the stories in the book. One thing I found that there was a commonality in terms of the importance of the point of or the event or the ritual of coming out. And I felt that there was a lot of precursors to that and the effects to that to these people. So my question around it is that as time has passed, has that ritual maintained its importance, or with the acceptance in society after several reforms coming through, it has become more acceptable and casual is not the right word, but less painful?
So I think you've got to remember that the interviews in this book, the earliest ones were done in 2012, and the latest couple were done in 2020 and 2021. But the bulk of the interviews were done prior to 2016, 2017. Mm-hmm. So we're already looking at an experience that in some ways may be historical, that the experience of people now coming to maturity may be different yet again. And yet for the guys that I spoke to, I think almost without exception, there is still this point of having to claim one's identity, as we say, to come out, to say, I am gay, this is who I am, or whatever words people want to use, queer. One person spoke also of his or their experience with gender and wanting to be non-binary.
Mm.
So there is always a point at which people feel the need to define themselves. And the reason for that is that there is an accepted norm for the majority, that the norm is still heterosexuality. And for many people that I spoke to, there was still the perception of the need to define themselves against that norm as different. Now, I know and I hear anecdotally from young people coming through growing up now that may be changing in some environments, and that there may be at least parts of the community where young people coming through don't need to go through that coming out process. They just simply engage in the relationships with whoever they want to engage with. But for the guys that I spoke to, it was still an important milestone. And particularly, people seem to go through stages. They'd often come out to their friends before coming out to their parents.
Yeah, I saw that in some of the stories where they suddenly realize that they haven't told their parents yet after putting it on Facebook.
Yes. And it seems to be that, and maybe it's true of many, many different sort of aspects of oneself, that people find it easier to talk to their friends about things than they do to their parents.
Mm.
But coming out to one's parents remained an important part of the process of establishing one's identity amongst the guys that I spoke to.
And also I saw that depending on the family and ethnic makeup of the family, it could be more than just the parents, because I think it was a Tonga story in which they were the parents, and then he had to go and had a chat with his grandfather.
Yes, that's right. And depending on the importance of extended family networks, then coming out with those to those other parts of one's networks is really important. In fact, in Tonga's experience, Tonga is of Maori heritage and describes the importance to him of his Maori identity as much as his gay identity. And the experience that he described was actually of going to his grandfather's grave and talking to his grandfather at his grandfather's grave and saying, well, I think his words were, I guess I'm homo, what he said exactly.
Yeah. And I really liked his last line in his story. He said, all boats will rise up with my tide of pride, when he's talking about identity. So I just wanted to get into the identity aspect of sexuality and family and ethnicity. I did find that there were certain struggles within the people dealing with those aspects of being a human. Can you elaborate on that? How did you feel about that, and how does one align sexuality with other identities?
Yes, one of the things that I found from the people I spoke to was that, particularly for people with a non-European ethnic background, and I spoke to some people from a Maori background, I spoke to some people from a Pacifica background, and a couple of people from Asian backgrounds. For some of those, their identity or their cultural identity was as important or more important in the first instance than their gay identity. And One of those was Jonathan Selu, who is of Samoan heritage. And he describes how he was from his father was Samoan, but his mother was spoke English. And so they initially only spoke English in the home. And then at high school, he started learning Samoan and embracing his Samoan identity. And that was a hugely important part of his process. And he had to do that and claim his identity as Samoan before he got to the point of coming out and claiming his identity as gay. And we all also talked about Tongaporutu Neha, who similarly, it was very important for him to establish and claim his Maori identity and not let that be subsumed by what he saw as a very Western Americanized model of being gay, which, and I think this is probably true, that the commercial presentation of gay life is often very consumerist. It's often very very self-focused. And he was very adamant that he didn't want to buy into that model of being gay, that mm-hmm. being gay had to be something that was part of his cultural heritage, that didn't wipe out or didn't erase his cultural identity.
Yes, and I did feel that narrative flowing through across many stories, that there was a bit of a backlash towards the stereotypical portrayal. So that brings us to the stereotypes. Now, I found that a lot of people had that struggle because there was this stereotypical idea during their school time amongst their friends, and that was the main hindrance. I found it myself. I'm not gay. I'm a cis and heteronormative cis male. And even when I told certain people about my interview and the book that I was focusing on, I did find some comments coming through. So do you think there's still some work going to be needed in culture? Because I found that it's an ongoing process.
Very much so. Yeah. I think that there are different discourses that are prevalent in different parts of society. And certainly in New Zealand, there is one discourse which is around, very much around acceptance and normalization of different sexualities and different gender presentations. And that's probably very much part of the discourse of public life, if within government, within teaching, within public institutions like libraries, within academic circles, there's very much that discourse. I think there is probably also a somewhat more reactionary discourse, which is perhaps not so well heard, and perhaps not so clearly, not so publicly articulated often, but I think that still circulates. And I think that is, as you say, there is still work to be done in terms of promoting the acceptance of a range of different ways of being in the world.
Yes. With keeping the thread of identity as well, there were religious narratives as well. So there was quite a lot of openness to the acceptance of religion. And then there were some parts where there was religion was not looked upon as a favorable aspect. For me, I think what I gathered was that, I mean, the colonial time led to the introduction of Christianity as well, and that has seeped through our culture up till now. But do you find in your two experiences between the previous book and the current book, the attitude towards religion have changed?
I think actually there were some similarities in experience. And one of the threads that comes through is that people who have grown up in conservatively Christian environments do struggle more and do face more internalized conflict with their sexuality.
Yeah.
And so I think there is still a lot of negative messaging from the conservative elements of the Christian church around the undesirability or the unacceptability of being gay. And there are also narratives of, in the book, or one or two anyway, of people for whom being gay was something that's evolved alongside an active Christian faith, which was developing in a more progressive environment and in a more tolerant and open environment. So it's not so much the opposition of Christianity as such, but it's the conservative elements or conservative elements within the Christian church that in fact present considerable obstacles to young gay people growing up. And that remains a concern, and I think it probably remains a concern even today. And I guess one of the things I wish is that people would read not only these stories, but the stories in my previous book and all the other so many thousands of stories of gay people and queer people around the world, which say time and time again that one's sexuality is an innate, is experienced at any rate as an innate part of oneself. And we could talk a little bit more about identity and the constructs of identity, but the experience of people that I spoke to is that their sexuality is something that is deeply a part of them, and it is not something that is chosen. Sometimes it's not something that is desired. And so the journey is to find acceptance and ways of being and ways of loving and ways of being in relationships that are compatible and concordant with one's sexuality.
It is, I found it really intriguing because as I communicated to you through the emails, I'm new in New Zealand about 10, 11 years, and I'm from Pakistan, which is a very conservative Islamic country. So the conservative basis in religion that presents itself to the general the general congregations as opposed to homosexuality or any identity basis based on gender as well. I think that New Zealand is on its way a little bit further, and in Pakistan we need a lot more work to do. Now I really wanted to talk about internalized homophobia. So me from a colonized country from Pakistan, and in colonialism there is a theme of internalized racism. So can you elaborate on internalized homophobia?
Yes. So the idea is that, or the concept is that people growing up, or gay or queer people growing up, take on board, often subconsciously, a large number of negative messages around homosexuality or around being gay or being queer. And it is one of the things I found in talking to these the participants in this project, that often those messages are quite subliminal and come from all sorts of avenues. It may be from kids making comments in the playground, you know, oh, that's so gay.
Mm.
It may come from comments in the portrayals in the media. It may come from things that are unintentional things that are said by people around you, parents, adults, other members of the community. So often it's not even direct messages like being homosexual is wrong, but it's subtle and insidious messages around this being something that's not quite desirable.
Can it be classified sort of something like a bit of a microaggression in current terms?
Those sorts of things as well. Yes, yes. Mm. Yeah, those little and often slightly insidious put downs. And, you know, when I was growing up, this is going back a generation prior to the ones that I spoke to, but, you know, pufta was a term of abuse, a generic term of abuse. And referred to anyone, a man who in any way was deviated from, you know, norms of, you know, culturally determined norms of masculine behavior.
Yeah.
So, and you know, anyone who was outside the norm, if you're a little bit literary or artistic or dressed more flamboyantly or, you know, you could be at risk of being abused in that way, even if you weren't homosexual. So a whole lot of little, very subtle messages that come through. And so the idea of internalized homophobia is that people come to see something in themselves as being bad, and that can have effects on self-esteem. Obviously, it can have quite pervasive effects on how you present and operate in the world, on your sense of aspirations, on your sense of ambition. It can affect your perceptions of relationships. You know, when I was growing up, one of the messages that came through very strongly from all sorts of sources was that gay relationships didn't last. And in fact, many of them do, and many of them last very successfully. But so there was the idea that if you were gay, you were destined to a life of heartbreaking affairs. I mean, that's one example. That's not necessarily relevant to the people that I spoke to, but that's one that I brought through. So, yes, the effects of internalized homophobia can be insidious and long-lasting, and even relates to things, portrayals in the gay world and on dating apps and things like that. The desirability of being straight acting, for example, which was something that came through. People would speak about maybe on a dating app, and
I think Tonga mentioned
and so this whole thing that even though you were gay, you were wanting to be seen as acting straight. So that's, you know, that's another example of that, as you say, internalized homophobia. And I think there probably is a very valid parallel with internalized racism.
Yes, it is. I mean, it's not related to the book, but I'll share it with you anyway. It's growing up in Pakistan, it's always the general narrative in terms of the shade of the color, how it associates with your capabilities in society, does create through time an internalized displacement of thoughts within you that you feel that the shade of your skin is somehow related to how intelligent you are, or what is your prospect of getting employment. So there certainly are parallels in that. That's why I asked specifically that question, because it is quite pertinent. Okay, so just coming towards the wrap up, I really wanted to discuss about, almost everybody talked about how they would label themselves, either gay or queer, and there was a discussion in almost all stories around using gay at a different situation and queer as a different at a different situation, and that presented to me a very thoughtful understanding of identity by all the participants. My question was the importance of claiming back the words that were essentially maybe in the past can be used, might have been used offensively. Is that an important thing within the gay community and within the LGBTQI community? Because it is essentially in immigrant community, it is that way. So I just wanted to put that forward to you.
And again, very much so. The use of the word queer, which in previous generations was a term of abuse, and certainly when I was growing up, to call someone queer was a derogatory term. And so that's been reclaimed as an act, almost a political activism, and embraced. And I guess to take a step back, because I started this project in the context of a master's degree, I was interested in constructs of the self, and I was interested in the, if you like, from a theoretical perspective, the concept that the self is something that is that is constructed from social discourse or from social narratives. And I was operating within a post-structuralist sort of academic framework. So that motivated some of my inquiry. So I was interested in the ways in which people created their sense of who they were, or in the idea that people drew on prevailing social narratives to construct their sense of self. And as I said earlier, that theoretical framework stands in some tension to the repeated experience of people when you speak to them that their sexuality is something that is inherent in them, that is innate in them, and that's something that's been borne out by other oral historians as well. And there's been a little bit of a few papers written about that in academic circles, that tension between prevailing social constructionist or post-structuralist narratives around the mutability of the self versus people's lived experience of the self as being something that is innate. That's by somewhat by the way of a digression, but I was also interested in the language that people use to describe themselves. And so there's been if you like, there are different phases of language. So gay is used by many men who feel romantic and sexual attraction to other men, but it also implies something of a maintaining a essentially male gender identity.
Yeah.
And it implies something of a sense of operating more or less within established social social frameworks. Whereas queer is much more often in usage, it's much more radical in its applicability, it's much broader in its applicability. It refers to a much more generalized, if you like, rejection or moving away from heteronormative standards. So queer can mean a whole lot of things. It can mean a difference in your sexual identity. It can mean a difference in your gender identity. It can mean a difference in your gender presentation or the way in which you construct relationships. So it's a much broader category. And I was interested to find the to record people's experience of the language that they use to think about themselves.
So it was part of your part of the questions that you asked during the interview.
Yes, that was one of the specific things that I inquired about.
Okay, thank you. I mean, that was it was fascinating to talk to you, and your book is very engrossing, and it's fantastic because there are it is a multitude of emotions one goes through reading each stories, and I would recommend it for anyone to buy it and read it in a go. And it's and I was amazed how everybody was so articulate in telling their stories, which I loved, and I felt that everybody was very in touch with their feelings when they did have a chat with you about it. So the last thing I would ask, that did you find barriers that people had opening up to you, these participants had opening up to you, because they are very personal stories?
I was actually quite not surprised, but moved and honored that people, so many people, were willing to share so openly about their lives, and in some cases in quite intimate detail. And I've talked to a little bit, people have asked me a little bit about this elsewhere, that I think a big part of that is creating an environment where people feel that they're heard and respected, and that their story is welcomed. And my interviews would often last 4 hours. Sometimes I went back and did a second session. So having plenty of time for the interview was a critical aspect of the process. And the other thing is that I think, and it goes back to this idea that, and one person said that, Anthony Bailey said in his story that he grew up in a very conservative home in which homosexuality was not something to be spoken of, and he finishes his story by saying the experience of participating in a book being written about the experiences of gay men has been a sharp contrast to the themes of my life. Repression and silencing, pathologizing and invalidation have been replaced by the opportunity to be vocal, to be heard, to be normalized, and to be valued. And whatever I have to say, I have the space and permission to say it. And so for a lot of people, I think the experience was actually quite validating. And for a few, and the experience, if you think about it, how often in life do we have the chance to sit down and tell our story to someone over 3 or 4 hours and have that person listen and inquire and unwrap the detail of it? That is actually quite a rare experience.
Yes.
And I think a number of the participants found that experience valuable in its own right, quite apart from the outcome, which is what I hope will be a set of stories that will be valuable as a historical document, as a record of a particular time and place in history, and in the history of this country, Aotearoa, New Zealand, and in the history of queer lives around the world.
Well, thanks, Mark. I have so many questions. We can talk for hours around this, but we'd have to wrap this up. Thank you so much for taking the time out and being open about your work. What's coming next?
Well, I've got a couple of things percolating. I do have a collection of photographs of what for many is an institution in New Zealand, gay life, a place called Autumn Farm, which is a retreat in the South Island. And I've got photographs over that I've taken there over 10 years, and that's percolating in the background to be worked on and finished off and edited and brought to some sort of resolution.
Oh, that is fantastic. I'm looking forward to it.
And possibly some sort of more personal memoir, because I was realized as I was editing these stories that there were many points of resonance with my own life, and I thought that almost as a response to having shared so many other people's stories, sharing something of my own might be of value. So those are two things that are percolating in the background at the moment.
This most definitely myself and our listeners will be looking forward to it. I do remember that in the introduction part, you did mention fleetingly that it did come up, and this will be part of a memoir later. So it's kind of mentioned as a cliffhanger within the book. Thank you so much. The book is A Queer Existence. It is available through Massey University Press and anywhere you buy books from. It's available online. I checked through different platforms as well to buy and order it. So I would suggest everybody go and buy it. Now, I would like to thank you, Mark, so much for joining me. And hopefully we'll talk again over your next project.
Thanks very much, Ed. Yeah, it's been a pleasure to be here and a pleasure to be part of this. Thank you.